Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Placer, the owner and lead writer of Game Wisdom. Tonight, we got a great podcast for you. Join me this week from Digital Eel, Rick Carlson and Ika Karanen.
Hi.
Hi, guys. It's great to have you on.
Nice to be here.
Yep,
with you.
And what's interesting about this cast is that it's sort of like a full circle moment for me, because I talked about this, I think, on a previous cast, but when I first started my, I guess, quote-unquote journey into the game industry, the very first thing I did was beta test games for Shrapnel Games, and one of those games just happened to be your previous game, Weird Worlds Return to Infinite Space.
Cool.
And it's crazy to see where we are now. A Weird World, was that in 2003, 2004?
2005.
Yeah, so just about 9 years, I guess.
That's awesome.
And it's crazy just how quick the game industry has moved in even 5-10 years.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I guess to get things started, for people who aren't familiar with Digital Eel, could you tell us about yourselves?
Sure. I'm a musician. Been a musician for years and years. I gave it all up to make games. Went to Texas to do that. Met Ika in Texas at a place called Ion Storm. We worked together for a long time, but we decided to make games together about that time. It took a couple years to get it together, and around 1999, 2000, we started to make games.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's... That covers pretty much
everything. Pretty much,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, I moved to the U.S. to work at Ion Storm, like, back in 1998. I dropped out of college to do that, and that's where I met Fitch. And then, like, a year or two later, we started making this massive 4X space game called Infinite Space, which was, it was sort of inspired by things like Master of Orion and that kind of games. And this was a game that we never actually finished, but that's where we created the Infinite Space universe that Strange Adventures, Weird Worlds, and now Sea of Stars are all placed in.
Kind of that universe with all those races and artifacts, locations.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that stuff came from all of it, actually, I think.
Well, we've added a lot over the years.
Mm-hmm. And when you guys first started out Game Minister, that was during like the traditional publisher model. And as we just said, you guys started out, I think, with Shrapnel Games. Did you guys do any publishing before you joined up with them?
Yes.
Our first indie games we released actually through a company in Seattle called Cheapass Games.
Mm-hmm.
You know about Cheapass?
Sounds familiar.
They're more a board game publisher,
mm-hmm.
Like very particularly cheap. They all like, you know, printed black and white.
It's a fellow named James Ernest who's had a great idea that, you already have dice, you already have game money from Monopoly,
mm-hmm.
you already have pawns from your other games. So why should you have to buy them again?
Yeah.
So he made games without those pieces and sold them incredibly cheap, hence Cheap-Ass Games. And we've gotten a hold of him because his games are really weird. And we thought, oh, maybe he'll like these because our games are kind of weird too. And he did, kind of fell in love with them. So we did 3 or 4 things with him, including a little spin-off from Strange Adventures and Weird Worlds, which is real cool, a little table game
mm-hmm.
in his Dice Land series of games. But anyway, yeah, that's... So he did kind of publish CD versions of those early games, which was really cool, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to have a physical copy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting about the board games is that is a really smart move, especially what we're seeing with a lot of the Kickstarters today with people trying to kickstart board games.
Yeah.
And just like the amount of cost that goes into those games, it's just amazing. They may earn like $1-2 million, but then you just gotta think how much is that going to go into developing and printing all these pieces and boards and all that crazy stuff.
Board games are really expensive to produce, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
People would be surprised.
Yep.
There's a lot of art that goes into them for sure.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Even things like, you know, getting the dies made and all that stuff, it costs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, what's interesting about Digital Eel, as you just said, is that you guys work on both board game design as well as the game design for stuff like the Infinite Space series. And this is one of the things that we hear a lot of developers talk about, is like the idea of starting with paper prototypes or making your idea as a board game first.
Mm-hmm.
So, as designers, how, I guess, does the process change or is it similar when you're thinking up a board game versus making a traditional computer game?
There's some cases where you can do something, where you can test game mechanics in a board game, but one thing that's really good about computers is that they're very good at doing a lot of calculations behind mm-hmm. the scenes so that the players don't have to. So for example, like in Weird Worlds and all these Infinite Space games, we have our real-time combat system, which is something that you can't really test in a system that's based on cards and mm-hmm. dice. But you can sort of, there's some like basic systems that you can do in, that you can use in both, mm-hmm. both ways. Like we have our board game that's called Infinite Space Explorers mm-hmm. that has a card-based combat system. And it has this, feature that we call the reserve, where you can keep your ships in your hand and you can draw them onto the table to have them engage in combat. And then you can escape by pulling them back into your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of, after we developed that, it sort of gave us the idea of doing the same in Sea of Stars,
mm-hmm.
where we now have our deployment window where you can move ships in and out of combat.
Okay.
And on sort of the top level, it's the same thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But it's expressed in a different way on the computer.
Yeah.
It makes more sense there.
We've also gone the other way where you look at the real-time combat of Weird Worlds. It works a certain way when you play it. It's very slow. It's kind of like naval combat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just that translates real easy to a board game, you know, 2D board game kind of situation. Because you can do the movement similarly. You can do, you know, range. You can use similar weapons. You can model all that stuff. So it goes to a board game. Real nice too. So
mm-hmm.
that means
yeah.
it's sort of a translation process.
Yeah.
It's not something where you can directly
yeah
take something from a board game, put it in a computer game. It's sort of
reimagining it.
The thing. Yeah.
Yeah, basically altering, I guess, the abstraction that you're working with in one medium to the other. Because as you say, you can't really translate like real time movements and stuff like that to a board game. While the board game, you have to deal with hard rules, hard numbers,
yes.
mm-hmm.
which the computer can basically take care of when you're playing the computer game.
Right. So it's like on the computer, we can deal with weapons that fire dozens of times every second.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a board game, you would sort of condense that into like a turn where this weapon, you only roll dice for it once per turn, and it does this much damage.
Right.
Okay.
Don't roll 30 times.
Yeah, regarding the abstraction, I find that very interesting because a few months ago I was working with my co-host Ken. We were trying to make like a little basic game prototype. And what we did was I wrote up the design doc first, looking at the game from a computer point of view. And then he suggested, why don't you try imagining it as a board game as well? And then when I started thinking about that, you guys are worried about how the translations between the abstractions change. But if you have like that eye to it, you can sort of move things and maybe take something that you learn in the computer game to the board game or vice versa.
Right. Yeah, I think you can. I mean, I think that's also, it's a lot of fun to do that because you do get ideas back and forth from the two. They do kind of go hand in hand sometimes. I mean, mm-hmm. we've had that. Other games we leave alone. It's, you know, like a game like, you know, you've got some arcade games and stuff. It would be kind of intriguing to make board games out of them, but mm-hmm. they don't lend themselves, you know, as obviously or as well to being a board game as something like a 2D space combat game.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much in the zone.
There's some elements, of course, in the Infinite Space games that are very board game-like. For example, the whole exploration thing,
yeah.
where you enter a star system, you basically draw a card from a deck, find out what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Weird Worlds is sort of like an animated board game. Right? Mm-hmm. And when you look at the star map, it really could be represented on the table as simply what it is. And as you go move to each star, you would draw a card from the deck, you know, an event, and that would operate. They would operate the same. In fact, we've thought for a long time about making, you know, a literal kind of translation
mm-hmm.
of Weird Worlds to a board game. But we like the idea of doing a super fast mini game version of it. You're sort of a fast play mini game kind of thing. So we ended up making Infinite Space Explorers, which is like a micro game version of what's already kind of a micro game. But yeah, it's really fun. It's really cool.
And it's interesting that you brought that up, Rich, because that's one of the defining characteristics of the Infinite Space series is the fact that a typical play lasts maybe 15, 30 minutes thereabout. Yeah. But then those 15 to 30 minutes each time are going to be a different experience. And as you said, it is akin to that board game where you're drawing a different card, which will affect the event, which will affect what you do at that point on the map.
Exactly. So, you know, you kind of create your own story, your own narrative, each time you play the game, which each time you have a play session. Mm-hmm. So that works out really good. And of course, as designers, you have to kind of, you know, it can't simply be random stuff happening all the time. You have to kind of do that in some clever ways to make sure that you don't get gibberish, you know, when you're flying around. Or, you know, a result that would be just stupid or lame, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of have to tweak those lists and play around with things to make sure it really feels like a place rather than some sort of construct.
Mm-hmm. And that
I'm
brings...
sure if I put that right, but yeah.
And that brings up another question I have for you guys, and that is regarding designing a game that's built around randomization. When we see a traditional linear game, you can build a game, you know, level by level, mechanic by mechanic, and so on. But when you're designing a game that is meant to be not only replayable, but different each time, how does that factor into the design process when you're coming up with how the game is going to work or play?
Right, so designing a game like this, it's more like designing the world,
mm-hmm.
Designing like how the universe operates and reacts to what the player does. So that you can have a completely like a non-linear, non-scripted story to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, but also there is, you know, we're making a game, as you said, that lasts just a few minutes. We want you to be able to play it to completion, say in your lunch hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a limited number of, you know, pieces in the box. So you do have a big picture of how much there is to the game,
mm-hmm.
before you dive into it. We also have the advantage we've made, you know, similar versions of this game before.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're making a game like Weird Worlds, Strange Adventures came before that. So that kind of, you know, we knew the scope of the game. We knew kind of generally how many starships, how many items, how many life forms, you know. Because mm-hmm. otherwise, if it's, you just dive in and everything is open, you know, you're going to get into a lot of trouble. You'll follow a lot of, you know, paths that aren't going to end up anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of having, you know, I think back to board games where there was a limited number of components in the box, and yet, and I kind of referring to some of the board games that do roguelike mechanics,
mm-hmm.
that randomize things, you know. It's kind of good. To, I'm sorry, I kind of lost my spot.
you can ramble on. It's all right. Yeah, we're both fans of roguelike games.
Yeah.
So we sort of like that randomization aspect where you don't really know exactly what you're getting into. You have an idea, but you don't know exactly what to do from the beginning of the game. Right, so traditional roguelikes are like the thing that makes the roguelikes fun is that you sort of invest in this character and you really have to try and keep your character alive.
It's a simulation.
Because you don't get second chances. You don't have save games. You can't, like, you know, do a quick save and then try to do something that you know is very stupid and likely to get you killed just because you know that if you fail, you can just reload. But at the same time, that's sort of they end up being games that you never really finish.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to make a game that you can finish, you know, at a reasonable amount of time. So we sort of made this shortened roguelike type of thing,
mm-hmm.
where it's like you'll either fail or win pretty quickly.
Well, that has an interesting effect too, because, you know, normally when you're playing, say you're playing, you know, Dungeon Crawl, like Stone Soup or NetHack or something, you know, you're investing hours and hours and hours into this character, and you get a good one. He's staying alive. Can't believe it.
Yeah.
He's down to level whatever. He's discovered, you know, the secret areas, whatever. You've been playing for 20 hours, and then he dies. Oh, my God, you know.
Yeah.
For most people, that's going to be, even if they get that far, that's going to be the end of their experience with the local. They're just going to say it's just not worth it. The irony is that's just the thing that gives a roguelike tension. is that every step counts. You really have to ponder it. And that's the beauty of permadeath. But with a fast version of it, what happens when you die real quick is real interesting. You want to play again. So it's sort of like one more potato chip. It's real easy to get over death when you play Weird Worlds because you just want to play again. It's so easy just to start up a new game. So you can play actually in a half hour. You might be able to play a couple, two or three sessions, you know. But when you get one that, clicks, you're still over. You know, the game still is done. So I like the short aspect because of that. It has, it does a real neat trick from it.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. And it is very interesting to see the difference between a short game and a long-style roguelike game.
Because sure, a lot of people... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, go, finish your thought.
Oh, I was just going to say, a lot of people, you know, some people have criticized that. Or they get the game and they have expectations, you know, about it. And they go, well, what happened? It's over in 10 minutes, you know. And so we wish we could convey that, you know, this is kind of something special. It's a different than a lot of roguelikes have taken. There have been a couple that have done this, but very, very few.
Yep, and as I was going to say, I do find myself preferring either short to, like, middle-style roguelike games. Because as you said, when you're playing, like, a 30, 40-hour roguelike or something that big, and you die, you know, like, the 29th hour, it's like, like, do I really want to go through that whole thing
again?
Am I going
to put that again? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you'll take a break from it for 6 months before you go back.
Yeah, and I would say the example for me would be I've been trying to play Diablo 3 in its hardcore Iron Man mode, and all they basically did was say, okay, here's your 30, 40-hour RPG, but now, you know, one death and you're done. And then it's like, you know, I get to, like, level 55, and then the boss just, like, one-hit kills me. I'm like, oh, there goes 20 hours, you know, throw it out the window type deal.
You really do have a decision to make there, and the maker has handed you that decision, and you know that's a big decision, and that can make a difference between playing the game again, buying another game from that company, all kinds of things, so or whatever. But you know, don't get us wrong, we love roguelikes, and I know Ika has finished. Have you ever finished NetHack?
I haven't finished NetHack, but I've finished Dungeon Crawl.
Yeah, we finished Dungeon Crawl a few times, but, you know, that's over years and years.
And for me, I would say the two that I like, the other short-style roguelikes, would be, like, The Binding of Isaac and FTL. Yeah. Those two were, like, two of my favorite games. And as you said, they're designed to be these short experiences, maybe 30, 40 minutes long at most. But then the randomization, the replayability kicks in, so each 30, 40 minutes is going to be its own unique adventure. And as you said, Rich, it lets you basically tell this unique story each time you play.
Right, and it's you know, it's the player's story. I mean, the player picks the path, which is really cool. Can you think of any other kinds of games that let you do that? I mean, most commercial games, you know, you're not so much on a rail, but, you know, there's a story that they want you to, you know, get every bit of, but you can't really deviate at all from it. And once you play it once, what's the point of playing it a second time?
Yeah.
You know all the surprises and secrets. So, you know, roguelikes just kick butt, you know, over a lot of these other games.
Yeah, it's like the coolest thing about these games is that you have when you play the game, you can then tell your story about what happened in your game to your friend. Like, whereas with like a linear story game,
everybody's
story is the same, so it doesn't make any sense, you know. You can't, like,
I mean, people
tell
will
somebody,
you know how it is, like with FTL guys too, is they'll say star log, and they'll give a star date, star date, and they will recount their adventure playing that game as if it were a season of Star Trek, you know. And they're fun to read. They read, like, you know, decent fiction. If somebody writes it up that way, and they do. They write out, you know, after action reports and write them as if they were, you know, a short story.
Yeah, one of my favorite after action reports I read, it was by, I think, a PC game editor at the time, I think Tom Francis. He wrote an AR for Galactic Civilizations 2.
Nice.
And it was just like an entire narration of his time playing that game and how his choices, and he basically wrote all his backstory. And
oh, that's great.
And it was just such a great thing to read because strategy games and roguelikes, because they are open and random, it's not a linear experience each time, really lend themselves to letting the player define their own story. So I guess with that, I want to move on and ask you guys a few questions regarding how things have changed for selling your games as opposed to just design. Because as we talked about, Digital Eel has been around since the early thousands when the traditional publisher retail model was the dominant strategy. And since then, we've seen how we've just moved to digital with Steam, GOG, and how it has really affected not just the market, but basically gave independent developers a big shot in the arm. So for you guys with Digital Eel, how have things changed for you guys since we've moved from retail to digital?
Well, we were actually, when we were selling our first indie games, we were using some of the earliest kind of digital download purchasing systems.
Mm-hmm.
That was really sort of in its infancy at the time.
You know how it was, right? I mean, there really wasn't much of anything you could do, but there were a few ways to go. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Right, it's just like there were services that would do it, but they were not very widespread, and people didn't sort of trust them very much.
Mm-hmm.
Or there were places like Yahoo and places like that that were trying to get into smaller games and putting games online and stuff. But a lot of those places didn't understand what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was very hard. They would look at your game, but you know, it didn't fit what they had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
or whatever. So sometimes people would turn down the games, or they put them up for a couple of days, they wouldn't do well. It was very, very hard to get stuff happening online. That kind of. So that's why having CheapAss do some CDs for us, that was actually pretty cool. They didn't sell very many, but you know, at least it got the name out there and got the names out there. And it did help in the long run, definitely. James Ernest is a great name in games. He's pretty well known as a really great designer, award-winning games he's put out. So that was a feather in the cap.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, it's interesting how the early digital sort of mirrored traditional retail at the time. Because when you look at retailers, at least from 80s to early thousands, they were pretty much like the gatekeepers in the same way. If they didn't like your game or they felt it would be too weird or edgy, you know, they would just not sell your game, and then you have no other recourse to get your game out.
Sure. And you know, that's the thing, is what you want to do being independent is you want to make games that, you know, no publisher in their right mind would touch, you know. And that's the irony, of course, is that then you want to turn around and appeal to those people to help resell our games. But it was funny. It was in the middle of kind of what we have now and sort of the old shareware model, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it was very precarious. There were a lot of us talking about and wondering, you know, what would happen with indie games? Would there be an indie label? Would there be, you know, what kind of distribution would occur? It was interesting to see what happened, and I think it had a lot to do with casual games, you know? Some of these other things that came in and kind of pushed things forward and showed people that, you know, indies can be good money makers. They can be very appealing. So, you know, sometimes I kind of, I don't feel great about that casual kind of collided with indie. On the other hand,
mm-hmm.
it really gave indie, you know, its sort of foundation for indie game makers to make more money,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing what they do, if that's what they're after. You know?
One thing that definitely changed the theme is that it started like a marketplace where you can find games. Even though we had digital sales before that, those services were not set up in any kind of a way where a large number of people would be like going there and browsing the catalog.
Yeah.
We would basically, like, the only marketing you do there is you would upload a file and you might be able to like put in like one sort of a 50 pixel square image that goes with it.
And that was it.
There's like absolutely no way that somebody like who didn't already know about your game would be able to find it there and buy it.
That's where, Shrapnel came in.
Yeah,
too.
That's kind of why we went with Shrapnel.
Yeah, you want to touch on that.
Yeah, so it's like when we were picking, when we were deciding how to distribute Weird Worlds, that was one of the reasons why we went with Shrapnel Games, is that they were, this was, at the, when Steam was kind of not there yet.
Yeah.
And so that was like one way where we could get some kind of publicity. They had sort of a community around them.
Of a built-in audience, you know, mm-hmm. that was there. So you could, how would you put it?
So the people that might be interested in your game but haven't heard about it yet might see it there. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's hard to find a way to connect with a group of, you know,
yeah.
the people who are the kind of people who want to play this kind of game, you know, ironically. So you're trying to reach them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot better now than it was then. But, you know, thankfully Shrapnel was there. Thankfully Cheapass was there for us. And, you know, some other companies like Astroware, you know, who did ports for handheld
mm-hmm.
stuff for us. And they're awesome and they've helped out. I mean, all those guys helped us get our games out there and us kind of keep doing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was worth the wait. I mean, we hung in there for a long time with Steam and some of these other services too, like, who else? Desura, of course, everybody's heard of Desura. And you know, a lot of these other places are really fun to work with. And the fun thing is everybody works with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another difference that did not exist. I mean, the thought of Steam working with Desura, working with Indie Game Stand,
mm-hmm.
that was a mind blower. I mean, I know people in the industry that still doesn't make sense to them. They still don't trust it, you know. And you have to say that's just the way it works. And it's a great thing.
Yep, and it's interesting that you brought up the difficulty with finding an audience, because it's something that we hear from a lot of other indie developers as well, that you can sell your game on your own site and you're going to get some sales, but unless someone knows you beforehand, no one's going to, you know, type in, like, on Google exactly your company or your game. And that's sort of where these digital stores have helped the indie market. Because when you go on Steam, you're going to not just see the games you're interested in, you're going to see, you know, all the advertising, all the publicity for other games.
Right.
And it has really, I think, helped the indie market in that sense. But this has also raised, I think, the debate about whether relying on these digital stores is, you know, too much of the golden ticket. Because I've heard horror stories of people, you know, trying to move, you know, heaven and earth to get onto Steam so that their game would get the visibility needed to stay profitable.
Right. Well, when you get into issues of whether a game is profitable or not, then things get interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, what we do is we really don't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I really mean that. I mean, we make games because we love them and games that we want to play. Eco works full time besides doing this. I don't, so I kind of depend on this, but
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not married. I don't have kids. I live very cheaply. So, you know, making indie games is fine. And Eco makes a living besides it. So, you know, we really don't need to make a lot of money doing this at this mm-hmm. other point. So for us, that realm isn't as much of a concern.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't to say we don't want to see nice sales. You know, we want as many people to get the games as we can.
Right. So the way you publish games on Steam has sort of changed in the recent years,
mm-hmm.
where it's becoming more streamlined, where you don't require as much like time from the Steam developers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In order to update your games to release them there, you can set up more or less the whole like the store page yourself. You don't have to have their guys do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to help a lot in terms of like they'll be able to handle a bigger volume of games from indie game makers
mm-hmm.
being published. And I think that's going to help a lot.
Yep. And we're seeing Steam experiment further with Greenlight and Early Access as a way of giving the consumer more control over what games they want to see on the platform. But then this also raises issues of quality control, because we've seen a lot of less than stellar games get on the Steam, such as The War Z. The one that I just heard about was Air Control. Like games that are just like pretty much designed with like the barest of bone programming and then, you know, released for $10-$15.
Sure.
And then we run into the issue of whether or not that affects the consumer confidence in the market. And that raises, you know, a whole nother can of worms right there.
That's interesting stuff. And I don't really think about that stuff, though, is my thing. How about you, Eco? You have any comments?
I sort of think that it's going to sort itself out mm-hmm. just because everybody is connected to the internet now.
Yeah.
And like Steam comes with the discussion forums where when you're thinking about buying a game, you can go and instantly find out what other people are thinking about it.
They'll be very frank, too, of course. You know, so if there's something like, you mentioned a couple of other games there, you know, that are, well, less than what we'd like to see on Steam, you know, people will talk about that, as you know. they'll voice their opinions loud and clear and in great numbers. So maybe there's some check and balance there, too. I mean, that's going to happen in such situations.
All right. So with that, let's move on then to what the, I guess, the big buzz of now, which would be crowdfunding and Kickstarter, and how that relates to your, of course, the game you guys are working on now, Infinite Space 3. So with the Kickstarter, that's another relatively new development or new craze that has sort of taken root in the game industry. So for you guys, I have a few standard questions I like to ask developers who've had Kickstarter projects. The first one is, did Kickstarter have an impact on you guys developing Infinite Space 3, or were you guys going to develop that regardless and Kickstarter was just like a happy coincidence?
No, it was part of the plan.
Okay.
Right. So so we had this issue where we needed more people to do art.
Mm-hmm.
And
one of the guys that founded our little group with us passed away a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Bill Sears, who was primarily, you know, our primary illustrative artist, and he did other roles too. But when he was gone, he left a big hole, and we needed to find artists to fill that spot.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Right. And when it was just the three of us, it was, you know, relatively easy to deal with. We would just split any money we get three ways and be done with it.
There was no funding or anything like that.
That's right. But when you get then, but now we have, you know, like six, seven other people, and it's sort of, it gets more tricky than that, where not everybody's doing the same amount of work. It's,
it's managing folks, you know, and you also, you can't expect, you know, Bill worked once again, you know, as a labor of love, and you know, that's awesome. And we have people working with us who would do that too, but you can't expect everybody to do that. So we wanted to have, you know, money to pay these folks.
Yeah.
That's really primarily what the Kickstarter was for. Yeah.
Okay. Now, with the Kickstarter, I was looking at the page. So you guys were able to, of course, make the funding for it. And I guess another question I have for you, and this is another one of my regular questions, is, were there any elements of the Kickstarter that you guys felt that worked really well for you? And were there any parts that you may have misstepped or you would have done differently if given a second chance?
Probably more updates. Earlier, I think. But I think that went okay. I mean, we made the funding. We really didn't need anything else. We wanted to get that. Let's see. Thinking about it, what would you say?
But I mean, it's both good and bad. There's it's not necessarily a bad thing, but when you're doing regular updates on something like Kickstarter, you'll have to sort of concentrate on what can I show this month? What can I show this week? So it changes your focus a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Where without that, we might have developed the game in a slightly different way, where we would have been sort of undercover for a longer time, and then unveiled it in a more complete state. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really, you know, that it's against my nature to reveal something before it's finished. You know, everything about me says you keep it under wraps. You know, it's the skunk works, you know, until you're done. And then it has a big impact. But that's just not the way how things are done. I mean, people want to be involved. The community wants in. They want to see. They want to play with it. They want to talk about it. And, yeah, it's affected the way we were, which is probably good, I think, you know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's...
I like it.
Certainly there's benefits to it. Like, for example, some of the people that, pledged us money, gave them a motivation to be more involved in, during the beta, giving us feedback and, really doing pretty good job testing it.
Really good. Amazing
feedback. We had very, very detailed, very, very thorough, helpful stuff from these guys.
And it's interesting how you said how it has changed in terms of developing a game. Because this is another interesting point between how the old ways have changed to what we see today. Because as you said, back then, you would basically just work on your game for, you know, a year, 2 years at a time and talk to no one. There'll be no information, maybe a screenshot on a site or like a two-paragraph blurb in a magazine. And then, lo and behold, one day game comes out, you get the reviews, and everyone sees it then. Yeah. But now today, you're basically, not only do you have to make the game, but you also have to sell it and market it while you're making it. So now you're talking to the fans more, you're putting up more screenshots, you're showing the game at states where, you know, 5-10 years ago, people would say crazy, you know, you don't want to show someone your alpha or your beta.
And it's hard, too, because you have to kind of sustain, or I don't know how to put it, you have to sustain this all during that time, too. And sort of self-sustain it, but by the same token, you kind of have to caretake it and nudge it a little bit here and maybe... maybe we should get that, update out a little sooner there. You know, we're always thinking about how to, make sure and stay in touch with people so they don't forget along the way, what we do. So far, so good.
And
you're helping out a lot.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, no problem. Another example, I would say, of a developer, wearing, the marketing and the design hat would probably be the guys Introversion Software and what they're doing with the game Prison Architect. They basically went the crowdfunding route, and they're just working on the game. It's been in alpha for over, I think, almost 2 years now. They've been putting out a different alpha version each month. And the same thing, like, the first, 5-10 alphas were barely playable games. And this was stuff that they were showing to, their fans and the general audience.
Sure.
And now it's at alpha, I think, 23, 24. Mm-hmm. And it's still, who knows when it's going to be done except for them. But people are still playing it. They're still putting out the monthly work on it. And as you said, you have to, give it that nudge. You can't just say, okay, we put the update out now. We'll talk to you guys again in 6-7 months. It just won't work.
Once you're on this, you're in it. You're on a train. And you got to take that train to the destination. And really, or it falls apart or something. That won't happen. That can happen. I know what you're saying, though. It's interesting when you see those projects, and people are so dedicated to them, and they hang in there, and I think that's awesome.
I think it's sort of a balancing act where you have to decide how much of what you're working on is going to be in reaction to what the fans say to the last person, versus how much you're going to be working on new stuff that they don't know about.
That you want to
get in.
Yeah, and that's another good point. One thing that I see in a lot of developer early access forums is people saying, why aren't these bugs fixed? The game keeps crashing. Someone's dude, it's alpha. They're not even done making mechanics, and how do you expect them to fix bugs?
And of course, you're right. And we can see, 50 bugs that they'll never, they might not see, On the other hand, they've caught stuff that, I have to bite my tongue.
Now, speaking about the change, and besides doing the Kickstarter, you guys also went on the Steam Early Access, and that's how I saw the game as well. So how has Early Access been for you guys, and has that been any major differences between that and how the Kickstarter turned out?
I see it kind of similar to the Kickstarter, actually, where we're doing updates on a very frequent basis. Actually, we're averaging about once a week. And getting, feedback from people all throughout.
It goes kind of hand in hand real nice, moving from that to the early access thing. Of course, you bring the Kickstarter people with you. They're playing it off Steam. They're getting it off Steam. So it's still one big happy family. And that's been great, I think.
Okay. And here's a question sort of unrelated to Kickstarter, but in the general sense, I'm curious about, is what are you guys' thoughts on how sales have really taken root in the game industry? Because this is another thing that has sort of changed in the last 10, 12 years, is I remember a time where games were pretty much released and that's it. Their price would drop $5-$10 in a year or two, but generally speaking, it's going to be $40-$50 for a long time. And now today, right now we're recording and the Steam summer sale is just ending. And this was a week of games, 85% off, 75% off. I bought a $10 game for 75 cents during the sale. So it's really crazy as someone who has been following the industry for so long to see how we change. So for sure. You guys, being designers and selling your games, what do you think about how sales have really changed the state of the industry?
It's a really good question.
And we're both sort of smiling at each other.
I don't know what to say. I think it's like it's just that Steam has made it so much easier to make a sale as an event than it would have been in the past with games being sold at stores. Because like in the traditional publishing model, you wouldn't really have any control over the pricing at the stores.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not, you know, if it's being sold at, you know, umpteen different stores.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be so many, you know, people in between the developer and the customer.
Mm-hmm.
There's no control over it. And now it's, you know, pretty much as easy as going on the website and clicking a few buttons and entering a number of how much you want to discount.
Mm-hmm.
It is weird, though,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, go to GOG and buy a $35, $40, $50 game for $10.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome, actually. You know, and as long as, I think if you have a good game that you're selling, and as long as it's selling and bringing in some revenue and doing okay,
mm-hmm.
does it matter if it's $5 or $35? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would much rather, personally, as a player,
mm-hmm.
it be as cheap as possible.
Yeah.
And if we can make up for it in numbers, which is what, of course, a place like Steam helps you do,
mm-hmm.
is you have access to, you know, well, literally millions of people, I mean, mm-hmm. theoretically. But, you know, you're going to make up for it in volume. And mm-hmm. and so it is. That's still a tough one. You talk to people outside the game industry, or mm-hmm. you talk to the oldsters in the industry,
yeah.
people like me. They say that doesn't make sense. And you say, well, no, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But that's how it works.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny that way. Well, you know, who knows?
Yeah. And like my own buying habits has changed so much. I remember like when I was like 2000, like early 2000s, where pretty much every week I would buy like a $50 game or buy a $50 game once a month and that would be it.
Sure.
Because I didn't have the money for anything else.
Absolutely.
And now today I may go like a month, 2-3 months, don't buy anything, and then I'll spend $100, $150 for like the last week on, you know, 30, 40 different games.
Exactly.
And then that will sustain me probably until the winter sale. And I still have games that I bought that I haven't even gotten to just because the deals are so good. As we said, you make it up for in the bulk. And then I think there's also the other factor of the hardcore fans, the day one buyers, who will get you the initial sales. And then having the seasonal sales or weekly sales is a way of getting the outlier. So the people who are interested in your game, but they don't know they're going to like it or not.
Right. It's a kind of a different audience,
yeah.
where people that are paying the full price are the ones that are really the true fans,
mm-hmm.
that would buy the game almost at any cost. And then
the ones that are rabid with foam, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and the people that will then buy it in the bundle are people that otherwise may not buy the game at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really lose money.
That's true.
But by selling it at a steep discount, because those people otherwise they would never have seen your game or considered buying it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think that is the big point that a lot of the older developers or the people who are against sales seem to forget, is that the sales are really meant to get, as you just said, to get the people who may not even look at your game or even know that existed, or they just want to try something new. It's like, hey, this game is $2, you know, what am I going to lose if I hate this game
for exactly.
$2? But then if I like it, then you have a fan for subsequent titles.
Oh, absolutely.
Here's the question I had. Now, I would say one consequence of the sales mentality is I think it has somewhat driven the value down for games overall. Because as I was saying, with my own buying habits, I was buying, you know, $30, $40 games, you know, like they're candy. But today, because of all the games I have become a lot more select. I was telling some friends the other week about this, but today, it takes a lot for me to spend more than $15 on a single game. That's, you know, like, oh my God, am I really going to spend all that much on a game? But then considering that, you know, 10 years ago, I was spending $50, $60, you know, like, here's my credit card, have fun with it. So it is kind of interesting how the mentality has changed. Because as we're seeing, selling a game for $60, $56 used to be the norm. But then as we're seeing now, you know, most people will only spend $5, $10. And then that's not, of course, counting the mobile market where, you know, spending 99 cents is considered this huge deal, which is even more crazy to me.
Yes.
Again, coming back to that old, you know, spending $60 on one game.
That's really interesting. I mean, it went the other way, too. I mean, there's always been, like, discount games.
Yeah. Right?
There's always been the $25 game, the $9.99 game,
yeah.
$50 game. But generally, in days past, that meant kind of a crappier game.
Exactly.
You know, a less than, you know, stellar game. Of course, that's totally different now.
Exactly.
So, you know, the big AAA, big budget games, they're still going to be $50. There's still going to be those games out there, you know. And it just, let's hope you get what you pay for. You know, that's what I look for, are you getting 8 hours of gameplay or are you getting 30 hours of gameplay?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes even, I think, more important now. So
yeah.
To really look at, are you getting your money's worth? Because if you go to GOG, you'll think, no, I'm not getting my money's worth. Look at what I can get here.
Yeah.
And games that aren't necessarily that old either, you know.
I know. I mean, I was just looking on Steam, and the new Wolfenstein game that I think literally came out a month ago for $60, they're already selling it at a $30, you know, percent off. That's insane when you think
about
it.
That's nuts, isn't it? Yeah, that's real different.
And you brought up a good point, Rich, regarding how a $20 game, that mentality has changed. Because I remember when we called those games, you know, shovelware tiles.
Sure.
And back then, you wouldn't spend $20 a game because you were pretty sure it was going to be a crap game, you know, something barely worked on, whatever. And now it's changed to where $20, like $10 to $20 is now considered, you know, you still get quality stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's going to buy a lot of game nowadays.
Yeah, and that's great, especially for the indie market.
It is.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, when Weird Worlds came out, it was $25.
That's true.
And that was considered, you know, kind of a cheap game.
Kind of a cheap game, you know. That's right. It came out. Shrapnel had it at $24.99 initially.
Yeah. So it's like now, you know, absolutely the same. That this kind of a game is it's a $10 game, like maybe $15, but
yeah,
more than that.
But it's so cool to sell it for $10. I mean, that game, it's exactly the right price for that game. I always felt funny selling it for a lot of money, although it was probably priced right for its day.
Exactly.
You know, 2005, that price wasn't out of line at all. But I like selling that game for $10. Feels good. Feels right.
Yeah.
You know? Because people are getting a great game, and they're not having to shell out a lot of money. I mean, they're getting a full experience, shell out a lot of money.
Yep, and it's interesting how one market that has sort of resisted for some time would be like the grand strategy or the war game genre. Because I remember looking on like strategy first and seeing like their grand strategy games for like $60, $70.
Yeah.
And part of that was because the market was so narrow that, you know, someone who buys a grand strategy game, that's it for like a year.
Sure.
And now even they're having sales. I was surprised when I looked on Strategy First like 2 weeks ago, and they're saying, you know, discount, you know, $30 for a game. Like, oh my
there
God,
go.
They're selling, they're having sales. It's going to snow now.
But yeah, and their sales probably are better.
Yeah.
You know, the same thing has happened with other software, too. And like when in the past you'd buy, you know, a 3D modeling package, it would, you know, it cost as much as a used car.
Yeah.
Now you can get one for free, or you can, you know, you can get one for maybe $100.
Yeah.
A slightly more professional one, but it's, you know, it has changed dramatically. I think people are just not going to pay as much money for any kind of software as they used to.
Mm-hmm.
How can we apply this to the rest of our society?
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I would love to like have like a $20 cable bill.
Right.
That would be, you know, heaven for me right now.
Awesome. Are you listening out there? You know, a model for you here.
Yeah, and it is really crazy how we have seen that. And this is one of the things that we've been talking about on previous podcasts and how the AAA market is sort of in a precarious position at the moment because they're going to have to decide, do we adapt and lower the price of our games or do we try to, you know, sell them at this price and still spend $5, $10 million on development and hope that we don't bankrupt the studio in the process?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I think, you know, the big companies that you know, have multi-million dollar projects, they're going to keep doing that. And yet, I'm sure the ones that are in the middle, the independents among them that are medium size or smaller, mm-hmm. they're already adapting. They're already thinking different games. But for the big companies, I mean the big games, I don't think it's going to change.
Yeah. Now, here's another question for both of you regarding how things have changed, and that is on the concept of DLC and microtransactions. This is another one of those big moments or big things that have sort of swept over the industry. Because as we talked about back then, when you spend $30, $40 on a game, that was it. That was a complete experience. You're done. You're not going to spend any more money on it until, you know, maybe a $20, $30 expansion in 6-7 months. Today, we're seeing developers have like day one DLC. We're seeing games sustain themselves over years with more content. You know, maybe $4 here, $2 there, stuff like that.
Right.
So for you guys, coming from that traditional, you know, complete experience model, what are your thoughts on how DLC has sort of shifted things?
Well, we haven't really done that stuff at all. I think, well mainly it's just that, like, when we're supporting one of our games, we're making updates to it. We release those for free. And it's like, And we have, you know, fan-made mods and stuff that, you know, it's their property. We don't sell it. So it's kind of, and we don't want to, we don't really even want to try to compete with that. Like, like we don't.
Well, I, personally, I'm not for it. I it kind of creeps me out. It's sort of like chiseling is how I, you know, the old word chiseling, where you just every last little nickel and dime. And, you know, we sell a game, it's complete. You don't have to worry about that. We're not going to come begging later for more money for this game. Now, you know, that's a different attitude. And I realize that probably, you know, most people would say to me, oh, you're totally wrong. That's not what is that, where it's at at all. But that's how I look at it, is in kind of an old-fashioned way. We don't need to make money around every single corner. We don't, you know, really it's about making a good, solid game. And to worry about those things, too. And, well, it's just one extra thing to be thinking about when you're doing the design. We've talked to people already about this game, you know, besides Steam, other people like GOG and stuff like that, and had suggestions, you know, are you going to have that available, you know? And I've said basically, it's possible, but it would have to be really pertinent to the game. It would have to be really something that makes sense. You know, if it smacked of, now we just want to make some extra money at all, we would never do it.
But it's like you really have to, like, to do that, you'd have to design the game.
With that in mind.
The beginning.
Yeah.
Can't add it on.
Add it on. Right.
Exactly. And that's another very interesting debate we see among developers, because we have guys like Valve with Team Fortress, Payday 2, pretty much any multiplayer shooter out there that are built around, you know, sustaining themselves over years with DLC, new gun, whatever. And then there's the thought of, like, a lot of indie developers like you guys who we're just going to make a game and, you know, we're not going to worry about leaving out this costume or this weapon and say, oh, we'll charge, you know, $2 for that down the road. We just want to make this complete experience. And it sort of gets into that very interesting debate, because we have seen the pros of DLC, as I just said, in terms of sustaining these games. Like, thanks to DLC, a lot of games stay around longer. They get more work put into them, where otherwise it would just been, you know, it's released, you know, bye. We're not going to work on this game anymore, because
Fair enough. Yeah.
Well, it's also like with us, because we're just, you know, two guys, and like after we finish a game, we'll, you know, certainly support it. We might make updates for it. Like, we release several things, you know, pretty substantial updates for Weird World, like, you know, years after.
Yeah.
But generally, like, when we're done, we want to start working on something new.
We want to be working on the next game.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like we don't have, like, you know, a team of people that are in sort of this maintenance kind of situation where they will keep working on the game and adding more stuff as another team is starting another game.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a different kind of organization where, at a game company, you can do that, where you have, you know, a whole bunch of people. But with, like, a small indie group like us, it's just not,
not feasible, really. Now, that actually brings an interesting question. Have you guys heard of the developer Arcen Games?
Sorry, come again?
Arcen Games, A-R-C-E-N Games.
No.
They've been doing very interesting things. They've been doing the model of they release a game, and then they basically let the market decide if they continue to work on it or not. traditionally, they would design these, like, massive games, you know, they make, like, 70, 80-hour experiences, and then, you know, it's, you know, the flip of the coin, whether or not it will succeed or it was worth that money.
Sure.
So now what they do is they release a game, and then if it does well enough or it becomes a big hit, then they'll release expansion content or they'll keep working on it. If it doesn't become a big hit, they'll just basically, you know, let it go and then move on to their next idea. And this was an interesting idea. I've spoken to the owner, Chris Park, on the podcast several times, and he's talked about how this has really changed their, not only has it changed how they work on games, but it has actually helped keep the company afloat. Because they try making these massive, like, they worked on one game for like 2-3 years, and it just bombed on them. And they were pretty much at the point where they may have to close down, unless, other than their one big game that was sustaining them. So
right.
It is interesting to see how the decision, as you said, there is a big decision between designing a game as a complete experience and then designing it, as you said, chiseling it away, saying, we're going to release this quarter
right.
of what we're working on, that's going to be the retail version, and then this part would be DLC, this part would be expansion, and so on and so forth.
Yes. I'm intrigued by that organization. I'll definitely check them out when we're done here.
Yeah.
I guess one thing that I would say is that sometimes you just have an idea that you want to make, and you have to go ahead and make that idea.
Yeah.
And it really, you know, if you were to talk to the community about it, they might say stop. They might say, no, we're not interested in that. And yet, you know, maybe that idea is still worth doing. Maybe you really, really like the idea, or you're in love with it, or you really do, whatever. So there's that too, is what we do is kind of make the idea that we're in love with. This is the first time we've opened the doors
exactly.
and let others in. We found it to be a really pleasant experience, so we'll probably do this again. But we've never done that before. These have always been kind of our babies, you
exactly,
know.
Yeah.
Nurture them, you take care of them, and then you kick them out into the world. It's an interesting point you bring up, and I'll definitely check those guys out. Thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, and I'm pretty much the same type of mindset. When I think of a game idea or think of something that I want to write about, and I come up with like this like mock design document, I don't think in terms of I'm only going to make a quarter of this. I try to do like the kitchen sink approach. I just put everything that I have on the table and then subtract from it after that. I don't into it, you know, thinking, you know, only making half this game and then pushing out another half later.
Right. Well, and what we don't want to do is a process that resembles the commercial game making process. So, you know, if you're making a game to please everybody else, that means you're kind of aiming for sales. And,
yeah.
and that, you know, you're putting something up front that we normally wouldn't put up front. It's the game that's the important thing to think about. Stop there, because sales are important too.
Yeah. With that, I have one last sales and Kickstarter-related question, then we'll move on to talking about Infinite Space. And that this is another popular question I like to ask developers who've had Kickstarter projects. And that is regarding crowdfunding's viability. What we've seen is that sort of the gold rush of the Kickstarter crowdfunding era has somewhat come and gone. There's a time where you could put up like any game idea and people would, you know, jump on that because the platform was so new. And now we're seeing people become a lot more cautious. We're hearing a lot more stories about Kickstarters that have either failed to deliver a project or have even just failed to meet demand. We've seen some who have succeeded, but then they still failed to game it.
Right.
So my question for both of you is, what are your opinions on crowdfunding as a sustainable model? Do you feel that it will remain as an attractive option for game developers, or do you think that something will have to change, or it may even just go away at some point?
I kind of think that it's still sort of in the early stages where people are getting used to it. So it's like we had this, like you said, we had a gold rush where everybody was jumping on it all at once. And then we have this, like, another wave of, like, larger companies that don't necessarily even need the money from the crowdfunding, but they're just using it as a kind of a
pre-sales,
which sort of goes against the idea of, like, of the sort of independent fundraising thing. It's like, so we'll have to see how it goes. Like it seems like right now it's getting to where most of the money is going toward these larger projects made by larger companies that might, you know, already have venture capitalist money.
Yeah.
Do the project anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it kind of remains to be seen, like, how this is going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that early success, too, I mean, that early craze, that's just brought more and more and more people in. I tried this, you know, this amazing thing. And because, and it's just kind of a numbers thing, it brings more people in, and that means more people who maybe shouldn't be doing it, you know. A lot of those projects that come in, of course, they screen them, they okay them, you know, they're careful about what goes up there. But maybe a lot of that stuff shouldn't be there, really. And I'm not dissing people in the projects, but I mean, you know, that's what happens when something becomes popular. Then everybody wants something.
Exactly.
And maybe some people, you know, probably shouldn't be there. And maybe that's what's happening, is it's kind of weeding it out a little bit right now. And that's probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do think that it's going to be a viable option for some people.
Mm-hmm.
It probably has to sort of stabilize where it's going to be fewer people than are trying to raise funds right now.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see if some of the other outfits that do it also stay afloat, because people talk in terms of Kickstarter all the time, but how are these other outfits that do this, how are they doing as well? And, you know, if things are going good, there should be room for two or three competitors, you know, with Kickstarter. I know they're out there, I know people are using them, but how well is everybody doing? I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's the interesting point. The only two that I know of in terms of crowdfunding would be Indiegogo.
Yeah, Indiegogo. Uh-huh.
And one that just started Patreon. And Patreon is one that I was trying to use for the site here, but I think one of the parts of the problem is that it's still relatively not known. Like, when you say crowdfunding, you're going to normally associate that to Kickstarter.
Absolutely. Which is unfortunate in that way, I guess.
Yeah.
But again, it's just, you know, a function of that. It got so much press and so many people. It's like a gold rush. You know?
Yeah.
Everybody wants to move to California, you know.
And only a few of those people are actually going to make money out of it, and the rest are may go bankrupt. They're going to bet the bank on it and may not have any good money.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I'm not saying, you know, don't be adventurous,
but
try it. Yeah. Go for it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, for some people, it is only going to be that. It's only going to be a short adventure, you know. But that's okay.
Yeah. And I just want to go back to what we were just mentioning about how the different Kickstarter projects have really had an effect on the platform. Because we're seeing guys who, they'll put out, you know, the game in beta, or the game is almost done, they just need that little extra money. Then we got guys who basically say, I have an idea, give me, you know, $15,000, and I'll try to get this idea. And then on the other hand, you got, you know, these major corporations saying, we're asking $200,000 to prove this concept to the guys who are actually going to give us the money. So it's very interesting how the platform has sort of expanded. And it's interesting in the fact that the game that really took things off was the Double Fine Broken Age. And at that point, they were pretty much pitching the idea. They had no idea what the game was going to be, but they're saying, you know, give us $200,000 and we're going to try and make this old school take on the adventure genre.
Yes, exactly.
All right. So with that, let's move on, and we're going to talk about our final section, and that is going to be on Infinite Space 3. So, over the cast, we've talked about Digital EO, we've talked about the Infinite Space series. So, for the people who aren't familiar, what is Infinite Space 3 about?
Well, it's a roguelike variant
mm-hmm.
that takes you into a hitherto unexplored region of the galaxy, known as the Purple Void. And in that place are undiscovered stars. Around those stars are undiscovered planets. You are the captain of a starship. You choose your starship. You equip your starship. You go out on your own, find your own path, adventure, and explore this place, which is a place of about 40 or 50 stars. And
no, there's only 32.
Oh, there's only 32.
That's a standard size.
Oh, I see. But, sorry, I got interrupted. Can I start over?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't know you had written a speech.
No, let me start over on that, though. Let's see, wait a minute, where was that? I totally lost it.
I'm sorry.
Oh.
Well, it's, it's basically a roguelike game where you have your starship that you select and you equip it. You explore this sector of space. It's kind of like a condensed version of a season of Star Trek, where each star you go to, you will find something new there. There might be some random event that occurs. You may find items. You might run into aliens. Some of them are hostile. Some of them are friendly. You can trade. You can fight. You can find allies and build up a small fleet of ships. And basically, that's more or less it.
It's an instant space opera. It's a space roguelike, which is kind of different because most roguelikes are fantasy based. And, you know, when we made this thing, we came from kind of the roguelike approach, but really it goes back to kind of 80s kind of proto roguelike board games and stuff. But, you know, when you get into roguelikes, it's always about fantasy. And so this was, you know, a way to take it in a different direction. It's sort of like a, I want to use the word miniature. It's like a miniature version of Star Control 2. Anybody out there remembers Star Control 2?
Yeah, I definitely remember that one. It's one of my favorites.
Sure, and I'm not sure if that really inspired the game, but you can't help but draw comparisons to it. Because it's, you know, an area of space full of many different disgusting aliens who all have their own, you know, agendas, and you go out and interact with these places and beings, and it's very much like a condensed version of that little thing. I think of it that way. So, yeah, it's like, I guess it's...
Yeah, another game that I compared to is Starflight, which has a lot of similarities with Star Control 2, except it happened to be the game that I played.
Yeah, yeah. Some people played Starflight, some people played Star Control 2. It actually goes back to a couple of old games from the 80s, but for me the inspiration was from, there was a company called SPI, and they made board games, you know, competing with Avalon Hill primarily. But they also had a magazine called Ares, and inside Ares every month or every few months, they had a free game. And one of the games inside was called Voyage of the Pandora. And it was sort of a take on an old science fiction book called Voyage of the Space Beagle. And if you get the reference, that's kind of a take on the Voyage of the Beagle. And
like Darwin?
Like Darwin. So that's what you're doing, is you're going out and collecting life forms from different plants. And in that initial game, I remember playing it, it was about 1983. And indeed, you set up the board. You choose a spaceship and a crew, and you go out and explore the stars. And I thought, wow, this is great. It's over in about 30 minutes, or in that case, maybe 45 minutes. You have a complete adventure. It's like Ika said, like a season of Star Trek. You fly back home. You add up your points. You have a victory. Really, the template for the game was there. We added a lot of things and kind of left some other things out. Like, you don't maintain your crew like you do in MPL or like in that original game, Pandora. But it really gave me an idea of sort of the template for this game. Later on, you know, I remember saying, that's the game I want to make. That's the computer game I want to make. So, and later on, you know, games like Starflight, mentioned, and Star Control 2, I went, you know, they're making the game that I wanted to make, except that they're humongous, and that's the difference, is that, you know, Weird Worlds and Strange Adventures and Sea of Stars are not these humongous opuses, you know, and we've been through that before. So.
Yeah. Now, with Infinite Space 3, is it still keeping to the original two games and how you only have X amount of days to essentially explore the galaxy?
Yeah, right now it's kind of the early access version. You don't have like final end game stuff. There's some story things that we don't have yet.
Haven't been implemented yet.
Right, so it's basically following the same basic formula as Weird Worlds, where you have a time limit. You try to explore the entire sector within that time, and that's your victory condition.
Okay. Yeah.
One way to look at that too is that's the basic game, and what Ico was talking about is there's going to be kind of, you know, different, more spectacular kinds of ways to finish the game, too. But the average game, you might just play to the conclusion where you return back to your origin and add up your points and, you know, see how well you did. Try to make the high score list and stuff like that. Other games might end, though, with you saving the galaxy or saving the planet or something like that. Those things already exist in Weird Worlds, but we've got some other ones in mind, too. And they'll happen as very rare occurrences when you're playing the game. You might play four or five games before you see one of these, you know, special kind of story endings occur. So, once again, trying to randomize it, keep everything fresh each game, and have a variety of different, kind of events that have different kinds of that.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I liked about Weird Worlds is how it has different endgames. As right. you said, sometimes that big event may show up, or maybe a different event will happen, but it's not like every game has the same exact beginning, middle, and end.
Right. It's fun to play around with that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're continuing to do that. Yeah, I don't want to, we don't want to spoil anything, though. And there, what you saw in Weird Worlds, I think we're going to, we'll be having most of that stuff now. Mm-hmm. But some new things,
And I think that's one of the things that sort of, I think, hurt FTL a little bit as a roguelike, because in FTL, the final boss is always the exact same encounter.
Oh, sure.
So even though the beginning and the middle are different, you always know what the ending's going to be, and that sort of affects your choices and makes it very easy to sort of game the system, knowing, if I know this boss is weak to X, I know to always look for X while I'm playing the game. But when you have the randomized end event, you don't know, what you're going to need or what's the best thing to have for that final situation.
Right, and sort of managing that, trying to be ready for anything is really interesting. You can't be ready for it all, but it keeps you on your toes. But we'll forgive FTL because it's a great game.
Yeah.
I bet you if you talk to him again, I bet you if he made a sequel, he'd probably do some other things
with that. Now, with Infinite Space, are there any new, starting conditions that you'll have in the game? I know right now you can choose between, one of four or five ships, but will there be the option to play as, a different alien species or different starting points or different variables, etc.?
We've talked about a lot of those things. They're on our list. We have a big list of things that we implement. I don't know how much of those things we'll actually implement. We'll have to see. There's a sweet spot there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's also something that we've had fans do that kind of stuff. There was a really great mod for Weird Worlds called the Urloquite Crusade, where you play one of the typically hostile aliens, and you have a whole new adventure as that species, and it really changes the game.
You're playing around with interesting things because on the one hand, of course, you're tempted to. Let people start out with, say alien, the ships of other races and stuff. But you're also kind of messing with the story a little bit when you do that too. So maybe it's best just to keep that stuff in the combat simulator and let people have their fun with alien ships in the combat simulator. On the other hand, people are going to say, well, I want to drive, a Tanru demolisher around in the game. I want to have that. I like that ship. So, we're still pondering those things. How much of that would go for? We talk about that stuff all.
Right. So it's like you can hire mercenaries that are aliens.
They have their
ships and
right.
and we may have some more of that than we had in Weird Worlds.
Okay.
I mean, it could be conceivable that you could take over a ship in some strange way.
We've talked about boarding parties, all kinds of things, and
special items, things that you can do.
Now, here's a question. This is one that I sort of asked you guys when I did the interview with you during the Kickstarter. I just want to bring this back up because I thought it's an interesting discussion. And that is on the concept of unlockable content. One of the things that we talk about with shorter roguelikes like The Binding of Isaac is how the game changes based on every time you win and unlock some new content or you find something that gets added into the randomization for subsequent plays. And I believe when I asked you guys as in the interview, you said that with Infinite Space 3, you wanted to keep things to be a complete experience. So when you play Game 1, anything that could be possible could happen in Game 1. It's not like you're going to lock things behind any kind of barriers or play walls.
Right. Yeah, I think what our goal is to simply have enough content in the world that it picks at random that literally anything could happen from the start. I don't really see a reason why we should like reduce the number of things mm-hmm. that happen in game one just to reduce the stuff later, because it seems artificial.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the game. It should be in the game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Okay. Now,
unlockable stuff. You know, it's almost a cliche to me because it goes all the way back as old as as long as there have been games, there have been things that where you unlock things. So it's not a new concept at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of a trendy concept, and I know that marketers like it, and I know that players like it too. Mm-hmm. So I think about it really carefully. We've talked about it. We may talk about it again. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to close the. We're not likely to do downloadable content, but unlockables. Once again, if it made sense to do it, if there was a reason to do it, mm-hmm. like you had one of those cool end games, and it was really important to do it for some reason, I'd be open to it. But there'd have to be.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Mainly we'll just try and make sure that we have, like, say, enough alien races that you will not see all of them in the first game. Like, you mm-hmm. see a third of them, or half. So just the amount of variables that
mm-hmm. are. You realize we're shooting ourselves in the foot by saying this, though. It could be an embarrassment of riches if we just keep releasing more and more content.
But that is like if we add content after the release, we'll just release it as new updates like we did.
That's what we do, is we just put out an update. That way everybody gets it, nobody has to excluded from it,
It's like you're getting, it's like you're getting new cards for your deck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So isn't it nice when you buy like a board game, and it has a coupon inside where you go online, you fill out the number, and you get the five really cool cards, just because you took the time to give them your email address, which they like, and all of that stuff. So
now, speaking about these new like standards or new features that gamers are expecting, are you guys going to include anything like achievements or Steam trading cards or ancillary stuff that has sort of taken root in popular video game culture?
Yeah, we intend to do all of that where it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing that I'm definitely going to look into is the Steam Workshop,
mm-hmm.
because mods are a huge part of the internet of these games.
Yeah.
So we want to make like the downloading and making mods as smooth as possible,
mm-hmm.
and Steam is going to make it easier.
Okay. Now, another big part of Inner Space 3 is the move from 2D to 3D and how that has sort of affected the design. So could you guys talk a little bit about how this move to 3D has changed, I guess, the design or the philosophy behind Infinite Space?
No, I don't think that has really changed the philosophy.
Okay.
There's some things design-wise that it changes. Mm-hmm. Like the way, for example, the star map lays out in 3D makes it more compact than the 2D map,
mm-hmm.
where you're always surrounded by a larger number of stars that are within a short distance.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's easier.
There are no edges to go from one to the other. That is to say, it isn't a square flat board, so you don't ever much fly from one end of the board to the other. You don't really have.
Right, and it's like we want to make certain things easier. Like we'll have more things going on at the home worlds than before.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can go in and. Buy a new ship, for example, and it's easier on this kind of a map than on a 2D map, simply because on a 2D map it would have to be it's laid out over a larger area, so the distances are longer.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to sort of get stuck behind like a whole bunch of other stars and nebulas and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now with the combat, I know the game features a similar combat system as Weird World. Are there any like new twists or new mechanics you're planning on having for combat with the move to 3D?
Well, the 3D it changes a few things.
Mm-hmm.
Not really a whole lot, but there's things like we have sort of layering with the ships, where we have like the largest capital ships are on a different layer than the others,
mm-hmm.
so that what it basically does it avoids some of the crowding, like ships colliding with each other. That's mm-hmm. the thing that would happen in weird worlds where
mm-hmm.
when you have your ships in close formation, move one ship and everybody else moves to avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
In this
which
game,
wasn't necessarily, you know, realistic or not that we're worried too much about realism, yeah. but it you know, it isn't necessarily desirable.
Yeah. And it made some of the like bigger ships particularly cumbersome because they yeah. would be so sluggish. And now that they're on sort of their own separate layer, they can move freely without having to sort of do evasive maneuvers all the time because the smaller ships are buzzing around them.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it kind of plays out in 2D really on the combat map. We've spent a lot of time on the UI though. It's much different, like interface wise. The way you control the ships, is much more fluid than before. You can sort of, just drag them around the board and draw paths for them.
You know, there's probably, mm-hmm. there's going to be effects and weapons and things like that that people haven't seen yet. So, you know, we're going to keep our lips zipped. So, that's ongoing. Work on the combat things. Yeah.
But it's kind of fun to have it in 3D also. Like, so you can turn the camera around, you can zoom in, you can zoom out.
Mm-hmm.
You have a nice big fat planet behind it. All those things that you want to see.
Yeah. Now, in the version I was playing the other night, I didn't see a way for you to actually use or interact with items in your inventory, which I know was a part of Weird Worlds. Is that going to be back in Infinite Space?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's sort of
when you get the bauble now, or you get the mirror, or you get any of those items, you can't use them, and I know. It's very frustrating if you want to. And you'll be able to. We just haven't implemented this.
Nice.
Yeah, sort of coming soon.
Yeah, I know. We're all waiting, too.
Yeah.
But there's work to be done before.
All right, and now here's a random question that I just have to ask. Was there any, like, deeper meaning for having cat and dog placeholder images for, like, the drives and the boosters? Or is that just, like, random screenshots on your desktop?
No, those are our pets, of course.
Well, see, here's the thing. When we made the Kickstarter thing, you know, one of the reasons is to, you know, feed the cats.
Yes.
So we might as well, you know, show where the money is going to.
Plus cats rule. Plus our cats are cool. But, you know, you've got to have placeholder images. So, you know, we thought cats. Well, actually, it was his idea.
I did that. I confess. Yeah, I mean, there's also a squirrel, there's a dog, there's, you know.
Fair enough.
I think there's a bunny.
How about a squid?
No, there's no squid.
No squids. Except on planet 10.
Yeah. But it's like, I wanted to have different placeholder images for, you know, different types of items so that we can still kind of, you know. Once you learn the placeholder images, you can still sort of at a glance see that, oh, that's a thruster, that's a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever tried to install a cat on a Star Trek? It's not easy.
But it has to be obvious that it's a placeholder, because otherwise it will never get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a motivation.
Well, suffice to say, the cats have been a big success, and we'll be probably using one somewhere in the game somehow. My cat. We won't go.
Another question I had, will there be like different difficulty settings in the full game, like ways to make the game harder or have, you know, tougher events show up, or is every run going to have like the same variable for, you know, craziness and easy or difficulty?
Do you remember how it's done in Weird Worlds?
Mm-hmm.
Where you kind of choose different parameters to make it harder and easier. Do you want to explain?
Right. We'll probably have something similar to the way it works in Weird Worlds.
Okay.
So you choose like this number of stars, for example. You choose how dense the area is with nebula material. More nebula makes it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Number of enemies, definitely, because we like to be really harsh usually, and mm-hmm. yet for some people you want to back that up a little bit.
Yeah, it's got this system where...
By the way, I'm one of those people.
It's got this sort of system where the enemies get progressively harder as the game keeps going. So, like, toward the end of the game, you'll see much bigger alien ships and stations
but
that are...
As the years go by, the technology improves in this game. So, you know, right, so...
We'll probably have a thing where a difficulty setting will basically affect how fast this happens.
So
yeah, or see if it will just turn up the tech level, you know, so to speak, and start out at high tech. But I'm not sure. You know, kind of like the idea of the you know, tech thing.
So when you guys say that the tech will improve, does that mean like weapons will start maybe, like right now you have like the scale goes, it's rate 1 to 5. So like when you say tech increase, you mean that it starts out with weapons at like around 2, 3 points of damage, and then maybe as the days goes on, you'll see 4 and 5 and so on weapons?
Well, and more than that, really, you'll see different classes of weapons.
Okay.
Right, so the way it works is each race has kind of a sort of a tech tree.
Mm-hmm.
That determines when they develop a certain type of weapon, a certain type of shield, certain type of engines, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And their ships will periodically go back to their home world and get upgraded with new items. So they'll actually, you know, go from a weaker weapon to a stronger weapon when they go back home.
Okay.
So it's like it doesn't just like increase numbers. They actually like it. It's kind of like going back to like one of those 4X games where the races are developing.
Mm-hmm.
It's developing
different technologies, and they will, you know, update their fleet, and suddenly they have this type of gun instead of that gun.
All right. So I think with that we can start wrapping things up. I just have a few more questions for you guys. So I guess the big one then is, do you guys have a plan for when you're going to release Infinite Space 3, or is that still far in the future?
It's hard to say. You know, it's the old thing. We don't have to work to,
mm-hmm.
you know, a deadline. So when it's done, you know, is when it's done. Soon, we hope, as soon as possible. You know, we want to get it done soon because we have other things we want to do. On the other hand, we don't call it done until it's really sweet. So, you know, that's the way it has to be. How long do you think? I don't know. It's really hard to say. Yeah. It's going to be out this year for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Cause at some point we're just going to draw the line, you know, on features, but our list is pretty sensible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't really fall for feature creep or any of that stuff. We've been through mm-hmm. this so many times that really, none of that stuff really happens. So, I mean, it's just a matter of really running down our big list. And that's what we do. That's what Ika does every week. You know, it gets a little bit, you know, just as everybody knows, working on these games, you get a little bit more done, a little bit more
mm-hmm.
done as you go. Advantage this time is we have a lot of help. We have, a bunch of guys helping us make the game, which is extremely great, including another musician this time, which is just dynamite. And our regular group of fearless testers, which are awesome, and now a whole other bunch of testers on Steam who are great. So, you know, this is, it's terrific. It's really a whole different experience. So soon.
Okay.
Months, you know.
Mm-hmm. Are you guys shooting for like every week update, once a month, every 2 months, stuff like that?
I've been updating basically every week. It's not really a, you know, a sort of set in stone that
mm-hmm.
I always keep doing that. It's just kind of worked that way. Because it's pretty easy to do a release. And we also use we use Steam for our, fearless testers.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put in weekly builds, for them to test, and as soon as we figure that it's stable enough, I can just, you know, flip a switch and
yes. It's
up in the public.
Awesome.
Pretty easy.
Yep. Okay, so with that, the last question then is, for the fans who are listening to the cast at the moment, do you guys have any final thoughts or something you would like to say to those listening?
Hey guys, thanks for being with us. Stick with us. This is going to be a great game. Trust me, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
All right, so I think with that, we can wrap things up. Ika, Rich, it was great talking to you today.
You too, Josh.
Likewise.
Yep, hopefully we can get together again. I guess hopefully with a better mic. Hopefully I can edit some of this out. Yeah,
promise.
Yeah, we'll get a better mic.
We'll get a better mic.
At least I can say that for once I'm not the one with the worst mic on the cast. So I'm good there.
Covered.
You should see this thing. It's like it's one of these white plastic. It says multimedia on it.
Oh.
It says multimedia. It's got to be good.
Yeah.
It must be, a 1999? I'm not sure. But yeah.
Yeah, I was using a headset from like 2001 before the first headset, so I can't really make my guys too much. It sounded like I was like for, I'm not sure I'll edit out the sound, but it sounds like they're like stuck in a rainstorm. When I first started, it sounded like I was in a submarine. Someone said, it sounded like you were recording from inside a submarine with all the echoing that was
going on. Just add some bubbles, you know, sound effects, and,
Yeah, you could run this like through some kind of a gooey filter, sound like we're talking from space.
Yeah, all right. So with that...
Excuse me. I'm all for it. I like that.
All right, so with that said... Ika, Rich, once again, it was great talking to you, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again soon.
Let's do it.
All right, thank you.
All right, so for those of you listening, thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, you can either write a guest piece for the site, or you can be a future guest on the podcast, and you can find that information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And if you'd like to contribute directly to improving the site, we are running, as we said, a, as mentioned, Patreon campaign to hopefully make some improvements to our recording and general stuff on the site. And you can find that information on the front page as well. So, thank you for listening to the cast this week. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.